You're listening to HuntertonChamberRadio.com, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Our studios are located in the CenturyLink building at 14 Mine Street, Flemington, New Jersey. The content and views of our hosts do not necessarily reflect the views of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. To contact our station, call 908-782-7115 or email onair@hunterdon-chamber.org. Thank you to our sponsors and underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programming.
Able to come in today, so you're going to hear from me. So what's happening? Well, one of the things I like to do, and anyone who's really interested in what's happening as far as cases in New Jersey, one of the ways that you can find out if you hear about a case that you've heard you're interested in, or if I mention something on the program, you can actually go on the internet to the judiciary website. In New Jersey, you click on njjudiciary.com and it will bring up the judiciary website, and there's a ton of information on it. One of the things that you might want are opinions. Now, opinions mean that's a case. That's a case that's been decided by one of our courts. And there are both published opinions and non-published opinions. So if you click on opinions, you'll see Supreme Court. Of course, all the Supreme Court opinions are published. So any New Jersey Supreme Court decision, and if you read some blurb in the newspaper, you may want to go on and really read what the justices had to say and how they decided it and why. Their opinions are very comprehensive, well thought out, and we have an excellent Supreme Court in New Jersey. It's recognized all over the country. So if you read some blurb in the newspaper that doesn't make sense, just go on the judicial website and get the whole opinion. So as I said, as I have said before, all of the Supreme Court opinions are published. And then our appellate level cases, some of them are published and some of them are not published. They're what we call unpublished. However, they're all on the website. So you can go in and read any one of the unpublished cases as easily as a published case. You just have to click on unpublished rather than published. By the way, please excuse my voice. I have been traveling, and of course I picked up that bug that I always get when I fly from place to place, and I've got it again. So please excuse my voice today. But in any event, there are very few trial court published opinions, and for one reason, the trial court judges are very busy and rarely have time to write the type of opinion that would be even submitted for publication. They're usually very specific, case-specific, and so the judges don't regularly submit them for publication or even submit them and see that they're unpublished opinions. We have one judge, and I'm happy to see that there's a trial judge here in New Jersey, Judge Jones, who has, in fact, written a number of opinions and had a number of opinions published. Those of you who have listened to me for the last few years will know that I believe it's unfortunate, truly unfortunate, that there are not more trial court opinions published. I know the judges don't have time to do it. Frankly, I don't think they're encouraged to do it. But the judges that used to publish opinions regularly, some of the opinions from Judge Kraft, for example, Judge Sorko, there's an opinion from Judge Glickman. These are all retired judges, and Judge Sorko and Judge Kraft are now deceased. But they really formed some of the real good opinions in family law in New Jersey. And of course, then we have the appellate division opinions. And the appellate division opinions, although in the past you really could not easily get the unpublished opinions, now they are accessible to anyone. The only difference between the published opinions and the unpublished opinions is that an attorney cannot cite an unpublished opinion in a legal brief. And in fact, if they even want to use it at a trial level, they have to provide all other unpublished opinions in the same area. So that's pretty difficult to do. And so often, I guess the difference in what the courts are saying is that they'll publish opinions that they think of are of wider interest. But frankly, so many of the unpublished opinions are very, very interesting, and they touch on topics that we don't have a lot of published opinions and maybe no published opinions on. So with that little introduction, I just wanted to tell you about a case where, you know, you sometimes think that the little guy never wins. Well, this is an unpublished opinion, meaning it was not approved for publication. However, you can obtain the opinion if you have any interest in doing so. This was decided on October 19th. And this, it's my little guy wins contribution for today. The case itself, excuse me, Mr. Zagorski was the appellant, meaning he's the one who filed the appeal, and he filed the appeal from the board in the Public Employees Retirement System. And this was the division of, it was an issue in the case involved the remedy sought by the Division of Pensions and Benefits from this man, William Zagorski. And Public Employees Retirement System, or PERS, there is a statute, and what the division sought from Mr. Zagorski, they said he had violated the Public Employees Retirement System statute due to his employer's failure to enroll him in the PERS pension system. So they didn't say he had done anything specifically wrong, but that his employer had failed to enroll him in the pension system. And he appealed from the final determination of the PERS Board of Trustees. And in this case, because it had to do with the Public Employees Retirement System, the not a trial court, but like the trial court, is the PERS Board of Trustees. And what they did is they directed Mr. Zagorski to repay pension benefits. Well, somebody would say, well, you know, so what? If he's going to be entitled to receive them, he should repay them. However, what they directed him to do was repay $85,411.41, along with an additional $5,002.27, very, very specific amounts, for missed PERS contributions. So he filed an appeal, and this type of an appeal goes to the appellate division. Doesn't go to the trial court, but it would go directly to the appellate division. And he argued that the board, the PERS Board of Trustees, erred by failing to apply equitable principles to reduce the total repayment obligation. In other words, he said, wait a minute, this is just not fair that you're demanding that I pay $85,411 because my employer failed to enroll me in the system. So the appellate court found that given the acts of omissions of both the his employer and the division itself, it would be unconscionable to hold him liable for the 16-year failure to detect that he was in a PERS-eligible position but not enrolled in PERS by his employer. So that's the takeaway from this. If, in fact, you're working for an employer that you should be enrolled under PERS, better make sure that you are. But in any event, what the appellate court said is that based on these circumstances, the PERS Board of Trustees' demand for full reimbursement was unreasonable and excessive. Therefore, the panel, meaning the appellate division, reversed the board's determination, holding Mr. Zagorski liable for the full repayment of the retirement benefits. And what the panel did, meaning the appellate division, remanded the matter for consideration of the equities. So what happens is that means when it's a remand, it goes back to the court or the board who entered the original decision. But what they're saying is that after 16 years, it was absolutely unfair to require this employee to repay the PERS the full amount. And obviously, this is, we can probably assume that he was not the highest paid employee in his company based on the fact that it was 16 years and $85,000. But can you imagine getting hit with that kind of a, you know, not exactly something that would cause you to, well, I guess it is exactly something that would cause you to lose a lot of sleep. So Mr. Zagorski is my, the little guy wins once in a while. Now, it's another case that is going to be of interest, although it was not approved for publication. It is a family law case, and it was the case was a domestic violence case, meaning that the plaintiff, who'd had a dating relationship with the defendant, alleged that he had been harassing her by sending her many unwanted text and social media messages, along with voicemails, and she claimed they were filled with profanities and derogatory and upsetting comments. So she sought a final order pursuant to the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act. And at the hearing, because she most likely received a temporary restraining order, and then within 10 days there has to be a hearing, and the defendant can of course come in and defend against the claims. And the plaintiff in that situation has to testify and produce evidence. So this situation, and this is used initials ECVRH. So EC sought a final restraining order, and she wanted to introduce evidence of multiple allegedly harassing communications stored in her cell phone. So that's what she wanted to do. She said, I have a cell phone. I have all these messages in my cell phone. And what happened here is the trial court took judicial notice that over the past decade, electronic communication has become a component of the routine everyday life, and that cell phones function as pocket-sized filing cabinets, which is true. I mean, how many people have messages, keep their numbers, keep everything in their cell phone, and you find that out, of course, when your friends lose a cell phone. But anyway, in this case, the court noted that the electronic communications were a frequent basis for alleged harassment claims in domestic violence proceedings. And the judge also noted that the problems inherent in the use of cell phone, in other words, trying to use that evidence, is really problematic. So what the trial judge did is found that it was appropriate to adjourn the domestic violence final hearing for 1 week to give both parties time if they wanted to. And they were instructed, in fact, that if either one wished to introduce evidence which was stored on his or her pocket cell phone, both the plaintiff and defendant should have tangible hard copies of such evidence for the court, and also with a copy for the other party. And the judge said, have them available by the next court date. And if either one sought to introduce evidence from their cell phone, relating to voicemails, video streams, or photographs, then they should be duplicated on a CD or DVD so that they could be marked for identification in a tangible form. So in other words, and any of us who have been attorneys, been in these cases, you'll have a client or the other person say, I've got all of this on the cell phone, and then how do you play it into or put it into evidence? So this is a very reasonable thing that the judge did. And the court also noted that generally, if a litigant is financially unable to prepare copies of text messages and emails or CDs and DVDs containing downloaded and relevant photographs or audio messages or video streams, the court then, in its discretion, could potentially dispense with the preference for hard copies and instead proceed as best as possible under the circumstances by viewing the evidence directly on the cell phone and describing the same on the record. But that's a very cumbersome process. And of course, this was not of course, but although this was not approved for publication, I think it may be now, and I'll check that. But this was one of the opinions by Judge Jones. And as I said, he has many excellent opinions that are published, or at least he writes many of them, and whether they're published or not, they're excellent. And this is going to be helpful. Now, another judge, of course, can handle this differently, but I think what Judge Jones has done is he's shown people how, in fact, they should handle cell phones, and if there is something incriminating on cell phones, that's the way to do it. So I'm going to play a spot from one of our sponsors so I can cough, and then we'll be back shortly.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunter Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Okay, I'm back. And so, as I said, anyone out there, if in fact you think you have evidence on a cell phone, make sure that you try to copy it out, either a CD or DVD, or, you know, actually hard copies, if you can do that, because it makes it much easier. I had a case where this, in fact, came up in a matrimonial trial. And it was sudden, and somebody had done something during the trial. And in fact, in that case, the judge did allow voicemail to be played on the record. So in that case, we were able to play the voicemail threats on the record, so that the record was able to pick it up. Because what happens now, at least in family court, we don't have court reporters any longer, unfortunately. So everything is recorded. However, that doesn't help if someone has a text message, because a text message obviously is not going to be recorded in the courtroom. And if you don't have a copy of it, then you can't mark it into evidence as a hard copy. So this was a good opinion, and certainly an opinion that will help. It should help anyone coming into court when there is a domestic violence situation where, in fact, there have been text messages, emails, voicemails left that are of a harassing nature. And what this also should show, however, is that people need to be careful about what they say, and recognize that that email, that harassing or threatening email that gets sent, or the text message, is there for posterity. The voicemail can be there for posterity. So I think sometimes people too often don't think before they, you know, click send on the email or, you know, send the text message. And so caution for everyone is to really read what you're sending before you send it and make sure that you realize how it might be interpreted. Because in fact, things, you know, profanity, calling, leaving messages at inappropriate times, all of this is evidence of harassment that can lead to a final restraining order. And it's not only is it husband and wife, someone who's had a dating relationship, and of course, that's not, harassment isn't the only thing. I mean, it's any one of the crimes, you know, assault. Stalking is a fairly new addition now to the criminal code, and so it can be stalking. So, you know, people have to really be careful. If you have any friends who are doing what you think is inappropriate in the way they're contacting or talking to someone that they've had a relationship with, you know, let them know. Final restraining orders can really create significant problems. For example, I had a young man that I represented once. He was in the military. And if, in fact, there had been a final restraining order, he would not have been able to stay in the military. He wanted to be in the military. He would have been out of the military because, in fact, if you're convicted of domestic violence, you are prevented from carrying a gun. So that can be very significant. A police officer, anyone who might have to carry a weapon, there's an added problem. There's a problem for many professionals if they're convicted of domestic violence. It can certainly impact many, many things. So, getting on to, I guess, something that is a little less controversial, or but it does show us that we have to be careful about the words we use, because this is a Supreme Court case, Cashin v. Bello, and of course that means it was approved for publication. It was decided on October 7th, and the reason I'm bringing it up is you have to look at statutes very carefully. In this case, the Supreme Court decided that the legislature's use of the word building in its singular form is both deliberate and dispositive. So the court said that the word building designates a discrete physical structure, not a number of such structures connected only by the ownership of land on which they sit. By the plain language of the statute, so this is NJSA 2A 18-61.1 paren 1 and paren 3 and paren, the converted garage constitutes its own building for purposes of the act, and plaintiff may evict defendants. So this was a situation where there was a question of whether or not the converted garage was its own building for purposes of the act. And what the court said is it did, in fact, constitute its own building. So, what you need to do, of course, is also look at contracts and look at statutes very carefully. That is surprising that that case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And I have not copied out the case. It's 22 pages long. I have not copied it out, but I thought that for anyone who might be interested in something like that, and how you have to very carefully look at a statute and what it says And in that case, it didn't say buildings. It didn't use any other terms that would allow the court to do anything other than conclude that building designates one physical structure, not a number of such structures. So that was obviously worth it to somebody to take it up. Now, again, what another family law domestic violence case, the defendant in this case appealed from entry of a final restraining order. And, of course, restraining orders in the family part are pursuant to the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act. I've talked about that act, talked about who's covered under it, and it's not something you want to be convicted of, believe me. Even though it's not technically criminal, it has really significant consequences. But in any event, in this case, the restraining order was entered based on the court's finding that she, meaning this woman, committed the predicate act of harassment. And she did so by sending an email to the plaintiff's employer. And she did that stating that he had, on several occasions, operated the company vehicle while under the influence. Now, this was done after the plaintiff advised her that he wanted to end their dating relationship. So, in other words, she was being vindictive. He wanted to end the dating relationship, and she said, "I'll get you." She contacted his employer and said that he had, on several occasions, operated the company vehicle while he was under the influence. Case doesn't say if it was alcohol or drugs, but it really doesn't make any difference. Now, so what did the appellate division do? The appellate division affirmed the final restraining order, finding that the email was consistent with the legal conclusion that the defendant's purpose was to harass and that the need for a final restraining order was not limited to protection from physical harm. So the need to prevent further harassment would suffice. So that is, I did not read this entire case. It sounds like she may have only sent one email. So it doesn't have to be repeated acts. And this is an interesting case because what always happens is in addition to the act that's being complained of, the plaintiff also talks about and includes prior acts. It's not exactly like the dog is entitled to one bite, but to some extent it is. In other words, if it's not a really serious situation and there have never been any other incidents of domestic violence or any kind of, harassment, stalking, assault, then they can be dismissed. I mean, you can't just go in and say, he harassed me or she harassed me and get a final restraining order. But in this case, it would be pretty clear to anyone that the only purpose for this jilted girlfriend to send the employer such an email was to harass. And why else? I mean, there would be no legitimate reason that she could have sent anything like that unless she wanted to harass and get him into trouble. So let's take a short break for some for the news, and then we'll be back with more of It's the Law.
This is USA Headline News. I'm Melody Burkett. A powerful hurricane is about to hammer Mexico's west coast. Forecasters say it's the strongest hurricane on record for the Western Hemisphere. Hurricane Patricia is packing maximum sustained winds of 200 miles an hour. Landfall is expected later today.
The actual size is much smaller than Katrina. However, the intensity over that small area is much stronger than Katrina was.
Mark O'Malley with the National Weather Service in Phoenix says Arizona and New Mexico are expected to stay dry, but Texas could get 6 to 10 inches of rain. It's over 100 miles from the city of Manzanilla. Former Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee is backing out of the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. Chafee leaves the race just 3 days after former Virginia Senator Jim Webb dropped out. 2 days ago, Vice President Joe Biden chose not to run. For the USA Headline News, I'm Melody Burkett.
Do you have trouble remembering names or where you left your keys? Ever feel like you're just in a mental fog? Over 140 million Americans over 40 suffer age-related memory loss. That's because as we age, our brains stop producing vital neuropeptides, making it harder to retain important information. In fact, by age 50, the average person has lost half their short-term memory capacity. That's why a team of neuroscientists created Cebria, a medical miracle shown in a double-blind clinical trial to dramatically improve short-term memory in just 30 days. Better memory and clarity can boost your career and help you enjoy time with your kids and grandkids. Call 800-413-8643 now to receive a full 30-day supply of Cebria risk-free. Dramatically improve your memory with Cebria. Just call 800-413-8643. That's 800-413-8643. 800-413-8643.
This is Megan Jones Holt, the radio host of the Rotary Hour and president of Boxes for You. Why am I a member of the Chamber of Commerce? It can be summed up in one word: opportunities. Opportunities to market your business and yourself.
Hunter Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Home Instead Senior Care. It's our passionate dedication to creating personal relationships between our clients and our caregivers. Visit our website at www.homeinstead.com/325.
You've got a friend.
Home Instead Senior Care. It's our passionate dedication to creating...
Good evening, this is Dr. My pal Igor. We want to invite you to visit us at the Haunted Village at the Red Mill in Clinton, New Jersey. Come by to have a cup of hot tea with me on October 9th, 10th, 16th, 17th, 23rd, and 24th. Tickets are on sale online at theredmillhauntedvillage.org. Prices are $30 for regular admission and $45 for express pass. Don't forget to scare up a coupon from our local merchants. We hope to have you soon.
Well, I guess that's Halloween is coming. And as I said earlier, if you haven't heard, that there's a card club next Friday, the 30th at 8 in the morning. Wear your Halloween costume. It's at Financial Resources on Church Street. So what else is happening? Well, one of the things that I hear often from parents is, why can't I just stop paying child support? And why are the probation departments, why do they make me file applications? Well, here's another case where Mines, and it's the appellate division. So there was, in this case, the plaintiff appealed the denial without a hearing of his application to have the party's 22-year-old daughter declared emancipated and to terminate his child support obligation. Okay, this, you know, obviously 22 years old, why am I still paying child support? And so what happened in this case is that the appellate division reversed and remanded, finding that while the judge denied oral argument after finding that no evidence beyond the motion papers themselves and the existing record was required, that the judge had misconstrued the essential argument made by the defendant by concluding that the daughter's education was interrupted by a medical hiatus when none was asserted. The appellate division therefore said it had no confidence in the conclusion that oral argument was unnecessary. And oral argument was, in fact, needed to provide the plaintiff with a full and fair opportunity to present his request. And it chose not to consider the merits of plaintiff's contentions more than 1 year after the motion was made. It also noted that the judge did not consider what effect, if any, the provisions of the party's property settlement agreement regarding emancipation had on his application. So this is, you know, very serious. Most judges, except on motions where oral argument is not asked for or it's a discovery motion, most of the time judges do allow oral argument. So what does that mean? Well, in the family court, and in this case, the parties were divorced and there was a judgment of divorce, and there obviously was what we call a property settlement agreement, and some people also refer to it as a marital settlement agreement. It means that the parties had resolved all of these issues. So I'm assuming that the court should have had, and the plaintiff should have produced and attached a copy of the property settlement agreement to his papers when he filed the motion. In this case, the judge decided not to even allow oral argument. So if the judge had had any questions about why a 22-year-old daughter was still unemancipated, he could have brought that up at oral argument. And that's what usually happens. Judges are very, very good. I find that the judges consider motions. The good judges often have questions if they don't understand something or something's not clear. And it gives the parties, and if they're represented by attorneys, of course, it's the attorneys who do the oral argument. But I think this is a good opinion. I think it, unfortunately, it should have been a published opinion because it once again confirms that it's important to allow oral argument and to have a full opportunity to present the issues. Now, there are times when, after oral argument, the court might order an evidentiary hearing. Post-judgment hearings are a real problem because the judges don't have time. In fact, I have a case right now where there was a hearing ordered, but because of the judge's schedule, it's been postponed and postponed and postponed. I'm certainly not blaming the judge. We are woefully short of judges in this vicinage in Hunterdon, Somerset, and Warren County, and there is just too much work for any of the judges to complete it. So when there's a post-judgment plenary hearing, they often get shunted aside or something else takes precedence, and it can take months and sometimes even years before they're heard. And that, as I said, is truly, unfortunate. So I'll get off my soapbox, except people out there, you know, you get the quality of justice that you insist on, and don't blame the judges. They're all working so hard. In fact, especially the family court judges, I mean, they're just totally overburdened. But we need to get our governor to appoint more of them. So that is one of the things that I really hope that people can understand, that it's pound foolish to not appoint the judges, and everything would go faster, legal fees would be less, people would get justice much sooner. So what else is happening? Well, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, that's the circuit that we're in, ruled that the statute of limitations for claims brought under the Individuals with Liberty and Justice for All. I guess I am still jet-lagged. But in any event, under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, the IDEA, is 2 years from the reasonable discovery date of the violation. However, the court also ruled that a timely claim can extend as far back as the student's rights were violated. So while this provides much-needed clarity on the statute of limitations, it creates a much wider window for the collection on compensatory education claims and exposes local educational agencies, including public school districts and charter schools, to increased liability. So it is it's clarified that a timely claim can extend back as far back as the student's rights were violated. So this, in fact, is good news for people who are suing, and not good news for the school systems that have to defend against these suits. And that is a federal court. So I've talked about the cell phone evidence, which I think is, as I said, that's going to be a good decision, so people know exactly what they can, what they should do, and how they should present evidence when they have messages on their cell phones, or messages, either text messages, voice messages, or obviously the same thing for email. I think most people find it easier to perhaps copy email, but you have to have something hooked up to your email in order to make copies. There was also a case with respect to a Ponzi scheme. And this was a case where the plaintiffs appealed from an order dismissing their legal malpractice action against this attorney and his former law firm. Now, this was dismissed on summary judgment, meaning that the defendant in this case said there's no basis for the suit against him. And the court agreed. The trial court agreed. Now, in this case, the attorney and the law firm did not represent the plaintiffs, meaning the people who were suing. However, he had prepared notes, mortgages, and other documents for a client with whom the plaintiffs invested nearly $3 million. Now, they made the investment believing that the, and she wasn't the defendant because this was malpractice, but the person, her name was Antoinette Hodgson. And they invested $3 million believing that Hodgson was operating a real estate investment business when she was actually operating a Ponzi scheme. And if you don't know what Ponzi scheme is, please look it up on the internet. It's a kind of the house of cards. You've probably heard of Bernie Madoff, but these schemes are schemes where investors are investing and their money is used to pay other people to make it look like it's a really viable investment when it's not. So in this case, there was a summary judgment. The trial judge said that this attorney did not represent the plaintiffs and had no duty to them. So the plaintiffs appealed, and they contended that the trial court misapplied the law concerning an attorney's duty to a non-client, as well as the law concerning negligent misrepresentation. And they also said that the trial judge overlooked their expert's report, overlooked circumstantial evidence from which a jury could have inferred the defendant committed fraud, meaning the attorney who had represented the Ponzi schemer. And also, the trial court did not resolve disputed facts in favor of plaintiffs. And the issue on summary judgment is that if there are disputed facts, they have to be resolved in favor of the person, in this case, the plaintiffs, because the defendants were seeking summary judgment. And so that in this case, the appellate court affirmed the summary judgment in part. However, they reversed the judgment insofar as the judgment dismissed plaintiffs' claims that they were refrained from taking legal action against Hodson, the Ponzi schemer, sooner than they did based on certain representations from defendant attorney. And these representations, the jury could have inferred, were knowingly misleading. So in other words, they got a little bit of what they were seeking, so they can go back and at that point try to convince the jury of certain things. Now, another case, let's see how we are in time. We still have a few minutes. Let me just play a couple spots, and then I want to talk to you about a case where someone was entitled to a new trial. So there are people who, although if you lose at trial level, it's very difficult to win on appeal. There's certainly cases that do that, and I'll come back and talk to you about one of them.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's physician referral service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Hi, this is Ruth Ann Disatel, celebrant officiant with Celebration of a Lifetime. When people ask me why I joined the Chamber, it's because I want to get to know you and what you're all about. And I want you to get to know me and what I'm all about. And together, I'd like to celebrate what we can do for Hunterdon County.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Okay, we're back. We'll wrap up in a few minutes. I'm Pat Smits, the host of It's the Law. And I wanted to talk to you about a malpractice case, a medical malpractice case. And one of the things that people always think is that they're going to, get huge verdicts from juries. Frankly, there are juries that are more generous than others. Certainly, this area is not known to have generous juries. But in any event, what happens is when a case goes to a jury, the jury can find for the defendant. And in fact, what they can do is they can, what they call it, is a no cause. In other words, a jury verdict returned and said no cause. And so the plaintiffs in the case lose. They're not entitled to anything. So the case I wanted to talk to you about is Lauckhard, Lauckhardt, versus Jens, Jeges. He was an attorney. Excuse me, he was the doctor in the case. So in this case, the wife, her husband was deceased, and she sued both individually and as the administrator of her late husband's estate. And the jury, after the trial, it was a no-cause jury verdict. And it was a no-cause jury verdict returned in this medical malpractice case against a doctor who was an emergency room physician. And she also appealed from three orders entered during the trial. And those three orders resulted in the dismissal of her complaint against Robert Wood Johnson University Hospital in New Brunswick and two emergency room nurses. And in this case, the plaintiff's theory was that her husband should have been categorized as a trauma patient upon his arrival at the hospital because he was in shock. And so the issue, of course, is would he have been treated differently if he had been categorized as a trauma patient, and should he have been categorized as a trauma patient. So I guess the first issue would be, should he have been categorized as a trauma patient because he was in shock when he arrived at the hospital? And then secondly, would he have been treated differently as a trauma patient if he had been so categorized? So what happened is, before receiving a CAT scan, he died. And the defendants in this case, the doctor and the other defendants, agreed that if he had been designated as a trauma patient, his CAT scan would have been prioritized before non-trauma patients. So that's the issue. And the emergency room doctor also acknowledged that trauma patients generally receive higher priority regarding access to the operating room. So in this case, then, the plaintiff contended that the trial court was an error in excluding certain expert testimony. And what the appellate courts did is they concluded that there was a high risk that the jury was improperly influenced by the trial court's exclusion of the expert's testimony describing the substandard care provided by the nurses, and the consequent, as a result, that was a dismissal. They concluded that there was a high risk that the jury was improperly influenced because the trial court excluded expert testimony describing the substandard care provided by the nurses and the consequent dismissal of the nurses and the hospital in the case. So in other words, the jury knew initially that it was a case against the hospital, the nurses, and the doctor. And so that when they found out during the middle of trial that the nurses had been dismissed from the suit, the hospital had been dismissed, the appellate court recognized that this clearly had the capacity to adversely impact the jury's assessment of his opinions as to, meaning the expert's opinions as to the doctor, and thus could have been outcome determinative. And so they, in this case, the plaintiff is getting a new trial. So the question obviously was, because the judge dismissed these charges against the nurse and the hospital after the expert's testimony, did that make it seem to the jury as if, you know, the guy was a quack? And so did that have an influence? And the appellate division said yes, and they're sending it back for a new trial. It doesn't mean anything different will happen. However, everybody will conduct the trial, I think, differently. And certainly those are, a real problem. So another thing, and I guess I'm talking a lot about family law, but people have to be very careful about what they agree to. I had somebody call me today, and he thought he might have agreed to allow his former wife to move out of state with their child, even though he didn't want it and had no idea of, I think he was pressured, he's not finally decided it, but he was being pressured into saying, okay, she can move to Pennsylvania. Now, for most of us out here who live in Hunterdon County, in some ways, does it make sense to require somebody to live in Phillipsburg versus Bethlehem? Maybe not. But the point is, it does make a difference legally, and so someone needs to know exactly what's going to happen if, in fact, they're going to agree that their children move out of state. And we have a lot of close borders, New York, Pennsylvania, and it doesn't mean that people shouldn't be able to move, but you have to really understand the consequences of what's going to happen. But in this case, there's another issue that's really important is, whether or not there are civil restraints in a case. So what often happens in cases where there's been a domestic violence complaint filed, the defendant will agree to civil restraints, either allowing the house, the other person to stay in the house, agreeing that there won't be any communication, barring communication, and that means that, and let's say it's a traditional husband or boyfriend, he will not be restrained and not have a final restraining order, so that the consensual restraints in a matrimonial case should give the person seeking the restraints protection, but it also means there won't be a record. So the defendant will not have a record of a final restraining order in a domestic violence. So these cases are often worked out that way, especially if the DV case part of the plaintiff is not that strong, or if there are reasons why it really doesn't make sense to have the final restraining order under the domestic violence statute. So in this case, however, there was a final restraining order against the defendant, however, what happened in that case is the parties had a consensual civil restraints barring communication, and the evidence was sufficient to support harassment where the defendant had violated the party's consensual civil restraints barring communication directly or indirectly, and the content of his emails were of a harassing nature. And there, court also, there were other violations. So, however, in this case, the court did grant a final restraining order, and the appellate division did affirm, and the issue was his continued violation of their consensual restraints. And often what happens, however, well, not often, what happens is there's no protection from the standpoint of the person who has a final restraining order against a spouse or former spouse or boyfriend has the ability to contact the police, and the police respond immediately. And if there is a violation, then the police have to act and have to arrest the perpetrator. And if there are civil restraints, the police will say that it's a civil matter, and they usually will not get involved. So in this case, what happened is obviously the defendant continued to harass and was ignoring the order, and the court said, no, we're going to now enter a final restraining order. So I think that's about the end of the program today. Hope I've given you some information that might be helpful, or at least interesting, to those of us who are kind of legal geeks, I guess I should say. And until next week, I hope to have a guest next week, David Perry Davis, and it'll be an interesting program if he's able to make it. So until next week, I will say adieu, and we'll be back with the sports guys after the news.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's physician referral service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
This is USA Headline News. I'm Melody Burkett. A powerful hurricane is about to hammer Mexico's west coast. Forecasters say it's the strongest hurricane on record for the Western Hemisphere. Hurricane Patricia is packing maximum sustained winds of 200 miles an hour, Landfall is expected later today.
The actual size is much smaller than Katrina. However, the intensity over that small area is much stronger than Katrina was.
Mark O'Malley with the National Weather Service in Phoenix says Arizona and New Mexico are expected to stay dry,